You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our examination of the current state of environmentalism as a special for the April Earth Day. And this is the fourth in a series. And we left off last time looking at a report by the Harvard University Center for Risk Analysis, which carried out the largest survey of life-saving public initiatives, so-called interventions in the United States, for which there was publicly available economic analyses. In total, almost 600 different interventions were analyzed by using extremely detailed evaluation procedures. They computed the cost of these interventions and the number of life years saved as a result of the interventions and rendered into similar figures. All the costs pertain to society as a whole, so no consideration was made for possible distributional consequences. Now, what they found was that there are tremendous differences in the price to be paid for extra life years by means of typical interventions. For health services, it is quite low priced at about $20,000. However, in the environmental field, it stands out as a staggeringly high cost per life saved. Similarly, the Harvard group looked at the costs for different government agencies where this was possible. And again, it transpired that the Environmental Protection Agency was astonishingly more expensive than simply giving health care to people. Although the prices were still only typical median values, it was possible to look at the distribution of costs in medicine as against the toxin control in the environment. It can be seen that in both areas, we have a group of socioeconomically free or almost free interventions, although the health sector has far more free interventions. However, it is clear that while the health sector has more projects in the below $20,000 category, most environmental chemical regulation schemes cost about well over $1 million per life year saved. Thus, the extremely high typical cost of $7.6 million for the EPA is fairly typical representative of the cost of saving life by means of toxin control. The advantage of this method of accounting is that it is possible to see the overall effectiveness of public efforts to save a human life. Information existed for about the actual cost of almost 200 programs that accounted for an annual spending of over $20 billion, which saved on average almost 600,000 human life years. An analysis of the data showed, however, that there was no connection between the efficiency and implementation. It was not that the most efficient programs were fully implemented and the least efficient ones had not been implemented or just begun. It was therefore also possible to ascertain, rather surprisingly, that the number of life years saved could have been much higher. Spending almost $3 million to control radionuclide emissions from phosphorus plants to save only one life per decade is a poor way of saving lives. If one really wants to save the maximum number of human lives, it would be much better idea to implement the most efficient programs first, and then to continue with less and less efficient programs for as long as the funds were available. Of course, weighing in the issues in relationship to other policy areas. The Harvard study did make such calculations and discovered that instead of saving almost 600,000 life years, more than 1.2 million life years could have been saved for the same money by implementing more effective policies. Without further costs, it would have been possible to save around 600,000 more life years, or 60,000 more human lives. This is certainly significant. Of course, it is probably impossible to redistribute all public spending to save human lives on the basis of this relatively simple analysis, not least because there can be of equality in various population groups, which will affect some of the results. Even so, the results are so unambiguous and so forceful that they are impossible to ignore. Moreover, considering our concerns about voluntary and involuntary risks that we've discussed, it is clear that most of the areas covered, such as outside occupation, which could be said to be voluntary, aim at preventing death, which is involuntary. For example, fire regulations for children's sleepwear, speed monitoring to reduce road accidents, HIV screening of blood donors, mammography screening, and radiation emission standards for nuclear power plants. Thus, even when taking the dimension of involuntary risks into account, all of the issues are broadly comparable. As a society, we use vast amounts of resources to regulate both health risks and environmental risks, such as poisons and toxins. We have seen previously that pesticides, for example, probably result in very few deaths. But because the media attention is so great, many people think that pesticides are rather dangerous. The consequence of the constantly repeated what I call the litany is that we thoroughly regulate and phase out toxins, but leave alone other areas which for the same resources could do much more good, saving many more people from dying from involuntary risks. If the litany makes us demand regulations of particular areas of the environment while we fail to consider how the money could otherwise have been spent, we actually create a structure in society in which fewer and fewer people survive, even as we spend more and more money. To use a harsh, albeit fitting metaphor, we could say that when we ignore the cost of our environmental decisions on the lesser regulations in other areas, we are in reality committing statistical murder. And the Harvard study gives us an indication that with the greater concern for efficiency than with the environmentalist hysterical claims, we could save almost 100,000 more lives every year, essentially for free. Powerful stuff. However, we have to exercise caution here. My analysis has shown that many of our deeply ingrained beliefs about environmentalism are not supported by the facts. Conditions in the world are not getting worse and worse. As I mentioned in previous shows, we have more leisure time, greater security, fewer accidents, better education, better health, more amenities, higher incomes, fewer starving people, more food available, healthier and longer lives. There is no ecological catastrophe looming around the corner to punish us. Consequently, we must stop giving our environmental thinking a doomsday perspective. It is imperative for us to see the environment as an important, but only one important part of the many challenges we must handle to create an even better world and better and faster progress for the rest of the century. Prioritization is an absolute essential if we are to achieve the best possible distribution of resources in society. The environment must participate in this sociological prioritization on equal terms with all other areas. Environmental initiatives must present sound arguments to be evaluated on the basis of their advantages and disadvantages, in precisely the same way as proposals to boost Medicaid, increase funding in the arts, or cut taxes. However, this necessitates that the precautionary principle is strictly circumscribed. This principle has become enshrined in many different international treaties, as in the 1992 Rio Declaration, where it was pointed out, where there are threats of serious or irreversible damage, lack of full scientific certainty shall not be used as a reason for postponing cost-effective measures to prevent environmental degradation. In this formulation, the principle merely informs us that since we can never prove anything absolutely, scientific uncertainty ought not to be used merely as a political strategy to avoid environmental action. The most obvious example here is global warming, also known as climate change, where the mere fact of scientific uncertainty is not in itself an argument against, or for that matter, for action. Rather, as we've discussed in previous shows on global warming, we need to look at the level of uncertainty, the direction of the uncertainty, and the particularity at the likely costs and benefits of different levels of action. However, this understanding of the precautionary principle is very, let me say, Anglo-Saxon, whereas a much more radical interpretation comes from the German version, the so-called Vorsorgenprinzip, the more common interpretation on the continent. This principle, in essence, suggests building urgency into all decision-making. In the Danish interpretation, it becomes giving nature and the environment the benefit of the doubt. But this is a very problematic argument. In essence, it argues better safe than sorry, which of course sounds eminently agreeable. However, such an approach ignores the fundamental insight from the Harvard study, namely that if we try to become more safe in some areas, we spend resources that we cannot be used again for doing good in other areas because funds are limited. Thus, saving extra lives at great cost, just to be sure, quite possibly means foregoing the chance to save many more lives more cheaply in other areas. Yes, climate change is an interesting scientific problem. However, climate is always changing, always has, always will. And one of the very interesting things about climate change is that virtually no one talks about the benefits of climate change: longer growing seasons, more food, more plant life, less energy spent for winter heating, and so on and so on and so on. So when you have politicians and scientists focusing only on the ill effects of a particular happening, you know that it's been politicized to the point where it is no longer scientific. Once it is pointed out that the challenges in the environment are special compared to other areas on a number of points, it gives us some room for discussion here. Some environmental decisions are incredibly hard to change. For example, once we have paved over a bog and plowed a moor and destroyed a specific species of amphibian that lives only in that bog or only on that moor, it is very expensive, if not impossible, to reverse. Some environmental decisions have consequences that reach far into the future. For example, during wartime, the expediency of wartime means that many toxic waste dumps were created and then buried and forgotten. And then decades later, the leakage from these poison the water of those who have moved into the area innocently, believing they were living in a pristine area. Nuclear power plants leave waste products that remain radioactive for untold millennia, affecting the decisions of many future generations who did not make the decision to place the nuclear plants there. Rather, it was their grandparents who made the decision, leaving the cleanup to their grandchildren. Some environmental processes have momentous effects, as we have discussed in previous shows. Global warming will have many and diverse effects, perhaps costing as much as 9% of the GDP. We don't know yet. All of these points are relevant and need to be included in the social prioritization schemes among the many different proposals which are being analyzed. But none of these points is in fact particular to the environment. Most of our more significant political decisions are hard or impossible to reverse. Moral and political decisions, such as the abolition of slavery in the United States, the adaptation of human rights in France, the legalization of abortion throughout most of the Western world in the 1970s, the stages in the construction of the European Union, all are examples of decisions which would be exceedingly difficult or even impossible to reverse. Equally significant, if smaller in impact, the decisions on the placement of airports, bridges, and other large infrastructure investments are examples of almost irreversible initiatives, as are zoning decisions, placements of schools, roads, parks, etc. Moreover, many of these decisions have important impacts that stretch far into the future. All such information needs, of course, to be included in our finer prioritization schemes, but the decision needs to be taken on the basis of this information and not by reference to yet another principle of precaution. Two further differences are often pointed out. First, the precautionary principle should emphasize our concern for the future and our unwillingness to hazard the future of our children and grandchildren. Essentially, this argument says that we are unwilling to gamble that new products or inventions will improve life, if there's an even a much smaller chance that we will harm life. In other words, that we are, in general, risk adverse, especially regarding our children. Again, this sounds eminently congenial, but this risk averseness cannot only be applied to environmental problems. Of course, introducing a new chemical with high promises for the future may nevertheless have a small probability of causing more bad than good. But equally, so may any other invention, maybe the development of, say, the computer and the internet, will end up making personal contact superfluous. We don't know. It is not likely, but it is conceivable. So if we are risk adverse in one case, then we need also to be in all other cases.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are doing a special program for Earth Day. Some of you may know that I founded Earth Day back in 1980 at Queen's University, and I was just looking back over the decades and seeing how far we've come with environmentalism. And I'm making a lot of use of the work by Bjorn Lomborg from his book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, Measuring the Real State of the World. I really like his statistical approach to environmentalism, which is as objective as I think you could possibly be on the environment. Last time, a little earlier, we were talking about the cautionary principle. And it's especially relevant when science is unable to give us sufficient information on the consequences of actions. But again, this uncertainty is in no way unique to the environmental area. We have very sparse information as to the social consequences of using computers and the internet. International rules a little firm knowledge of the consequences of various foreign policies. We know little of the economic consequences of the euro or of NAFTA, for example. Actually, it is hard to imagine any policy area of significant import where the full consequences are known with any reasonable degree of scientific certainty. Thus, any significant prioritization of our society is evaluated against the background of uncertain knowledge and our propensity to be risk-averse, and with the realization that the decision will be hard to reverse and have momentous consequences both for many people and far into the future. This makes the environmental proposals just one among many possible proposals, often considered equally important. That the environmental area has been able to monopolize precautionary principle is in essence due to the constant fear-mongering of environmentalists and their fear, and then spreading to us, making it our fear of doomsday. Of course, if large-scale ecological catastrophes arise, we might be more inclined to afford the extra margin of safety just for the environment. But as I've documented in many shows on this program, in general, the concept of a doomsday scenario is built on a myth. The whole point of prioritization is to use our resources as well as possible on the basis of all the information available. For this reason, the precautionary principle should not be used to tip the scales a bit more in favor of the environment, because the distribution would by definition no longer be the best possible for the limited funds available. In this way, the precautionary principle is actually all about making worse decisions than we actually need to. And if we want to back off from making prioritizations altogether, because it seems narrow-minded or cold, this still does not prevent a distribution of resources from taking place, only now it is no longer considered and well argued, but random and irrational. And that is my main point here, is that observing how environmentalism has evolved since I founded Earth Day, so many decisions are not based on science now, but are random and irrational. This hurts me deeply. Avoiding prioritization simply means that the opportunity of doing the best we can is abandoned. A lack of prioritization, backed by however many good intentions, can in the final analysis result in the statistical murder of thousands of people. So I want you to include this term in your new vocabulary, statistical murder, when unscientific facts are used to reorder the prioritization of funding so that funding goes not to the most important sectors, which will protect the most, save the most number of human lives, but are simply the priorities of some random assembly of environmentalists. If we do not make considered rational decisions but base our resolution on the hysterical claims of environmentalists, the typical feeling is that the world is in decline and that we will make poor and counterproductive choices. For example, these are case studies. In Peru, the authorities refrained from chlorinating the drinking water because they were afraid of the risk of cancer. However, thousands of lives were lost due to waterborne diseases such as typhoid. Today, it is considered to have been one of the main reasons for the cholera epidemic that broke out again with such vehemence in 1991. Had they known how low the actual risk of using chlorine really was, the epidemic would probably never have occurred and the lives of thousands of children would have been saved. In 1967, Paul Ehrlich predicted that the world was headed for massive starvation. In order to limit the extent of this, he believed, reasonably enough given his point of view, that aid should only be given to those countries that would have a chance to make it through. According to Ehrlich, India was not one of them. We must announce that we will no longer send emergency aid to countries such as India, where sober analysis balance between food production and population. Our inadequate aid ought to be reserved for those who can survive. And these are the words, not of my words, of course, but of Ehrlich. He was basically saying that India should be left to paddle its own canoe. However, looking at the situation today, India today has lived through Green Revolution. In 1967, when Ehrlich wrote these words, the average Indian consumed just under 2,000 calories a day, even though the population had almost doubled. In 1998, the average Indian got almost 2,500 calories a day. Had we paid more notice to Ehrlich and less to other more sober analyses, and the incredible willpower inspiration that surrounded the Green Revolution, things might have looked quite worse in India. As far as the Western world is concerned, I hope that these shows can lead to an appreciable change in attitude to environmental problems. We can forget about our fear of imminent breakdown. We can head more or less in the right direction, and that we can help steer this development process by focusing and insisting on reasonable prioritization. This is not to say that there are no problems. Of course there are. However, when we fear for our environment, we seem to easily fall victim to a short-term feel-good solution, which spends money on relatively trifling issues and thus holds back resources from far more important ones. We need to be rational and make well-considered decisions in our use of resources when it comes to the aquatic environment, pesticides, and global warming. This does not mean that rational environmental management and environmental investment is not a good idea. It is. Only, my point is that we should compare the costs and benefits of such investments to similar investments in all other important areas of human endeavor. On the whole, I believe it is important to emphasize that being overly optimistic is not without costs, but that being too pessimistic also carries a hefty price tag, not only in terms of dollars, but in terms of human lives, where money misinvested saves relatively few lives, where better investment of money would save many more. If we do not believe in the future, we will become more apathetic, indifferent, and scared, hiding within ourselves. And even if we choose to fight for the planet, it will probably be a part of a project that is born not of reasonable analysis, but of fear. And acting out of fear is never the best thing to do. We will continue looking at this in one more future show on this topic, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.